Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and this hour, I told you what's coming up. I'll tell you again, but in the next hour, we have to let you know what's coming up at the 6 o'clock hour. We will have people with us who are at the White House from the lesbian and gay community who met with the White House on issues, and we're going to hear from them and then hear from a very interesting former prison guard who runs a garden inside the Maryland State Prison with people who are incarcerated, but that's all next hour. This hour, Emory Douglas is in town. Emory Douglas, as I said, is former Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. He is renowned around the country and the world for his artwork. His artwork is that which adorned, not just adorned, but slights it too much, but the Black Panther Party paper, because it was really an activist piece of work. It's a work that emoted and translated the feelings of a community and a struggle of that moment. And some of those pictures that that he did in those days have become iconic, that hang in people's walls and living rooms. And his work is in museums around the country and around the world. He's here because tomorrow night, and we'll tell you more about this later again, there will be an exhibition of his work at the Cork Gallery at 1601 Guilford Avenue, which is at Guilford and Federal Streets. And the proceeds go to the Eddie Conway Defense Fund, which we'll talk about during the course of the hour as well. And there'll be a limited edition collectible prints of his work for sale at that event as well. And joining us with Emory Douglas is my dear friend Paul Coates, who I've known for probably many years, 40 years at least, if not more, that we've known each other, who was the head of the Black Panther Party here in Baltimore City, but is a businessman and runs also Black Classic Press and is an activist in his own right and a great thinker. So Paul Coates and Emory Douglas, welcome. Good to have you both in the studio.
Mark, thank you. Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. And the lines are open at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Emory, it really is a pleasure to meet you. I mean, I mean your work, for those of us of a certain age, at least, who grew up with this and the Black Panther Party and the paper, it was always there, and it spoke so loud, so vividly to all of us of the struggle people had in that period. But I would just want to introduce you to folks and let folks know they can go to our website at steinershow.org. And if you go to the website, you can go to the pictures that we have up there that Emory Douglas did, covers and parts of the Black Panther newspaper that they're from the exhibit in L.A. And we have posted that on our website so you can see his work as we talk about it. But let's take us back to this time. You were a student at San Francisco State College?
I was at everybody thought I was a student there because I was out there so much. I really went to City College of San Francisco, okay. Which was not too far from San Francisco State.
And so tell me how you got involved in 1967, what drew you into the Panthers even before you became its illustrator.
Well, like a lot of young people all across the country, there was a high levels of concern and with the police abuse around the country during that period, a lot of rebellions during the '60s. You had the civil rights movement going on, particularly in the South. You could see on TV the police abusing the civil rights protesters and marchers, and just for their basic human rights of wanting to sit at a lunch counter, of wanting to go to a school of their choices. And being denied, being lynched and brutalized, water hose being sicked on them, dogs being, water hose being sprayed on them, and dogs being sicked on them, and by the authorities. So all these kind of impressions played. Wanting to do something to change, respecting the civil rights, nonviolence. But I wasn't one of those who wanted to turn the other cheek. So like a lot of young people all across the country, you were trying to get yourself involved, wanting to do something, because you've seen police abuse in your community. You've seen the police come in, shoot a young African-American man, a young man, probably running from the police, from the scene, no gun ever found, being shot in the back, causing these kinds of retaliation, rebellions all across the country.
One of the things you just mentioned, I just want to paint this picture. It's an important picture, I think. And Paul, maybe you can jump in this as well, because I think that there's clearly, people are still very angry in a lot of working class neighborhoods in America.
Yes.
About police abuse and people abusing their authority, and it goes on, and people are still struggling with that issue here today in 2010. But the picture you're painting now, I think, is important, because it was in that period that you're talking about, it was a time when it was literally in most cities all white police forces They were almost like occupation forces. Yes. It was a, and people were being murdered in the streets by police in ways that I think is almost hard to comprehend right now.
Oh, yeah. Most of them were recruited from the South into the North to be a part of those police departments. There's documents, books that show that in Oakland, California, when we used to talk about that, that many of the policemen were recruited from the South. You had Klan marches in various cities and towns in California during that period, particularly in Northern California, where the Black Panther Party started at. In Richmond, California, right outside of Oakland, California, in Oakland, they used to burn the crosses during the 40s and the 50s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and you were an art student. I mean, you learned.
Yes, I became an art student when I was a young man. My first involvement with art was like any other young people, not doing nothing that has any significance to it, copying cartoons or trying to draw landscapes and things of like that. But as I evolved and I was into the juvenile correctional system, and as
you
I
weren't volunteering there though, were
no,
you?
No, 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 no. But I was in there for illegitimate activity that wasn't sanctioned by the state, you know. So, but my counselor had suggested that I take up commercial art. When I was, they heard I was going to City College. They said I should take up art. So when I went to City College, the counselor suggested that I take up commercial art. And through taking up commercial art, you learn the various disciplines of figure drawing, design element, how to put a newspaper together, printing, all of those dynamics that go into fashion design, everything. Other than what if I would have taken up fine arts, I'd have been a fine art painter, but I wouldn't have had all these skills that lend itself to what I had to do when I got into the Black Panther Party.
Now, that period of time, the stuff that you ended up doing, I mean, the story I read is that you ended up in, I think it was either Huey Newton or Bobby Seale's house or Eldridge Cleaver's
house. Yes.
When they were putting out the very first edition of the Black Panther Party paper, you just happened to be in.
Yeah. Well, that came about when I was involved, got involved with the Black Panther Party in 67. So it was a little after that. It was about 3 months after, around April. We used to call a place called the Black House in San Francisco. Eldridge Cleaver used to live upstairs, and there used to be a lot of culture events going on downstairs. And so it just so happened one evening, and Huey and Bobby used to come over there quite a bit to try to recruit Eldridge to be the minister of information for the newspaper. They knew of his skills as a writer. And so they would come over and try to talk with him. And so it just so happened one evening I came through there, and there was no activity, and Huey and Bobby were there talking with Eldridge downstairs at the table. And when I came in, Bobby said, I'm putting out the first issue of the newspaper. And it was a legal-sized sheet of paper, and he had just took it out the typewriter where he had typed all the information on the sheet of paper. And then he had some markers, and he was supposed to do the headline. And I was out just finishing out of City College, and I still had a lot of my materials. And so I told him I could go home and get them and come back and help him improve the quality of what he was doing. And he said, okay. And so I left, and it took me about an hour to go and come back. And when I came back, they were impressed that I came back. And so they said, well, you've been hanging around for a good while, and you seem to be interested. We're going to start the paper, and we want you to be the artist for the paper. You would be the revolutionary artist. So that was my first initial title for the paper, was the revolutionary artist. So I started on the next paper, which was the paper we called the Mayday paper. It was when we went to Sacramento. And that was the paper that I initially started cutting and pasting and working on.
That was that famous scene where the Black Panthers all came out with rifles from the state capitol.
Yeah, not
the
all. There were those who were there who were armed.
Right.
There were those who there weren't armed. There were men. There were women also part of this delegation. Yes.
That was a very that's another iconic scene. I think stays in people's heads when they think about the Black Panther Party. But yeah, but your work, I mean, it really stood out in that period. I think as. Symbolic of the struggles that were going on in the 60s and what you tried to do there. Talk a bit about that, what you were attempting to do as an artist with the Black Panther Party and what you were trying to portray.
Well, initially I was portraying the 10-point platform and program of the Black Panther Party. dealing with We Want Power to Determine the Destiny of Our Poor and Oppressed Communities, and dealing with the inferior education, dealing with police abuse, dealing with unemployment, dealing with the black men being drafted into military service, not being tried by jurors of your peers. All of these things were a part of that program. And so this was kind of reflected in the art itself. But it just so happens that we were arguing around point number 7, immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people during that period. And so Huey and Bobby used to come in while we were working on the earlier days of the paper, and they began to talk about the pigs. They began to define what a pig was. And so Huey Newton had asked me to do this first drawing of a pig on 4 hoofs, and we were going to put the badge number of the policemen who were acting up in the neighborhood on that badge each week. It just so happened that first pig drawing that I did was a badge number of a policeman named Fry, who was the one, when Huey Newton got shot, he got killed in Oakland, California, because he was notoriously known. And so it was thereafter, because of my experience at City College in commercial art, where you always had to evaluate your work against what was being done and critique it and stuff like that, to how to improve it. It just flashed on me, why don't I show send this pig up on 2 hoofs, put the pants on it, keep the gun holster, and put the badge, and keep the snort with the flies and the tail, and it became the pig icon that took on a life of its own. It transcended the African-American community, became a national, international symbol of oppression.
I think, again, we've done this before. I know when Paul and others have been on the program, and we talk about that time in our history 40 years ago, 45 years ago. It's amazing to think it was that long ago, and that now that's part of history. but that it was a time, as we were describing earlier, the exhibition you're doing tomorrow of your work is going to benefit Eddie Conway.
Yes.
And I think people don't have a sense of what that time was like, and the fear, the struggle, what was happening, people being murdered. It's really very distant for some folks to understand what you were living through, what many of the people were living through at that moment.
Yes. Oh, yeah, there we, little Bobby Hutton, first Black Panther who joined the party at the age of 16 and a half, was murdered by the Oakland police, shot over 17, 19 times. You had over 28, 30 Panthers who had been shot or murdered over periods of time. You had Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, notoriously known in Chicago, which was set up and got documents to show that Richard Nixon was being briefed on this by J. Edgar Hoover in relationship to this whole thing of setting up to go out to kill Panthers during that period. So it was a very intense period.
And let me just interrupt only for a second, because I think it's important. Yeah. Paul, let me say this, and I want you to jump in.
But, sure.
But what you just said, I just want to back up what you just said, because people, I think that what you're saying is not just something to be said. These are documents that were before Congress, before the commissions in Congress, and they were in the courts, and the redacted documents that came from the government explicitly say what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying this is not like something where we're making up some conspiracy theory out of whole cloth.
No.
That this existed. This actually is on paper and it's documented that it existed.
Yeah. And Mark, I was particularly being quiet there. I know you tried to get me in there a couple of times. But I was being quiet because Emory was really like the young brothers say, dropping history. You know, mm-hmm. He was really dropping a lot of history. And I was particularly struck by, I just want to go back a little bit, because I was particularly struck by Emory retelling his story and at the same time telling our story. And there were two things that Emory said, and I'll come back to the conspiracy stuff, especially as it relates to Eddie here in Baltimore. But two things that I noticed, Emory was talking about how much television played a part and a role in spreading the notion of the civil rights movement. And it was true, as you remember. I mean, we'd come home, we'd look at what was happening on the television. And those of us who were thinking, those of us that had any level of concern wanted to be involved and engaged in some way,
right,
and wanted to stop that type of oppression. And it was not too much unlike people who became less than a decade later engaged in the anti-war movement. You know, the television did that. You know, it was the pictures from Vietnam that really incited people and called them to action. And so when Emory was talking about how the television and the images of the civil rights movement called him into action, that just resonated with me because that's exactly what happened to me. My earliest call to action came from watching people hosed on television and wondering when this would stop and wanting to be a part of stopping this, my earliest knowledge. And one of the other things that Emory said that I thought was real significant as he was telling about how he drew this. He gave a graphic image to a situation of oppression. Mm-hmm. So he looked at the brutality of the police, and it was voiced already in the rhetoric of the Panthers in terms of describing what the pig was, a low-life traducer. And for those of you who don't know, the pig referred to the police officers and forces of oppression, period, in our community. And what Emory did was actually gain a power, and this was one of the things of the Black Power movement, period, and that was the ability to use rhetoric to define who the enemy was, and have that rhetoric work in a way so that it communicated a notion of who the enemy was and what oppression looked like very quickly, not only to people in the Black community, but people literally all over the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what Emory was able to do. It was almost a type of graphic rhetoric, if you will. He was able to take the rhetoric of the movement, and that's what his art reflected in large measure. He was able to take the rhetoric of the movement and graphically illustrate that, and so that you didn't have 1,000 Panthers out on the corner. You just had one image that Emory did, and it communicated those images each week would communicate all around the world and consciously inspire people and bring people into action. So listening to him talk about how he got into it was moving to me because I remember how much impact the images had on me and how much impact the images had on other people. And so I just thank you for bringing that history out.
No, I think, and what you said about the images, I think that was the part that I think people don't realize, that was the power of the images that you drew, that you created, that were in the Panther newspaper that went way beyond the Panther newspaper.
Yeah.
They were hung on people's walls across a country.
They were hung on city streets. They were hung on telephone poles. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it becomes a way of oppressed people literally defining their oppression and defining their oppressor. Mm-hmm. And calling out the name of that oppressor in a way that their oppressor could not take the name off, you know. In fact, the name stuck so heavy, and the graphic images along with it stuck so heavy that many of the police began to call their own selves pigs, okay? And they began to go with pride, integrity, and guts.
That's right. I remember that.
You have a case again. And I think it's significant to know that people are not powerless when they jump up and they resist their oppression. Yeah. They're not powerless, and it begins with defining what that oppression is, defining it and exercising some control over it through that definition. Mm-hmm. And Emory was not the only graphic artist in the party. He actually, were some that had worked alongside him, and he gave birth to a whole generation of artists that worked underneath of him that he was able to tutor and bring along, and they were able to do these same things with their pens, you know?
I think that it's important. By the way, we tell you just heard the voice of Paul Coates, who owns Black Classic Press, his own major printing business, was a former chair of the Black Panther Party here in Baltimore City. And we're here because Emory Douglas is in town for his exhibition opening up at the Cork Gallery, 1601 Guilford Avenue, tomorrow night. And all proceeds from that go to Eddie Conway's defense fund. And Emory Douglas, of course, former minister of culture of the Black Panther Party, who has created these iconic figures that still the world watches to go see. And lines are open here, by the way, at 410-319-8888. You can join us here with your thoughts and questions for Emory Douglas and for Paul Coates. And one of the things that I think that it's important to kind of point out some of the other kind of images that you created and before we kind of take ourselves into the 21st century here a bit. But I went through all the ones I could find again and going through some of my old newspapers and looking at them last night out of my trunk at home. Mm-hmm. And you had this one piece that really says a lot because it could have been today. When you had this picture of a beautiful portrait of an older woman, black woman, and the program the Panthers had back then, Seniors Against a Fearful Environment, safe. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And about taking care of old folks who wanted to go to the co-ops and get their food and bring the
yes,
food home.
Yes.
Those images were just as powerful as the anti-police images that you made of it. Not more powerful in some ways.
Oh absolutely, because that one was kind of take off in relationship to then in Oakland, California, other elsewhere around the country, where the police was spending more money on helicopters to patrol the neighborhood, talking about preventing crime, than investing in the youth in the community to help to prevent crime. And that's what I was trying to show because it had a helicopter looming over the image. And I was showing that where we had these programs, that this is what they could be doing. Instead of spending that $50,000 more or so on this helicopter, they could invest that money into these young people to take the senior citizens to cash their checks, to buy their groceries, to shopping, to do everything that they want to do if they're really talking about crime prevention, you see. So you invest in those young people, and then you perhaps can cut into crime.
And what you're describing, though, that particular thing you describe right now is relevant in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, all over the world. Everywhere I travel, you have the same issues today that you have then that are relevant right now. Yes.
I mean, if we took young people and paid young people to take care of older people in mm-hmm. the communities, that would go a long way to ending violence. It would go a long way to mm-hmm. kind of creating a bond between the elderly and mm-hmm. the youth. That
yes.
It's a very powerful idea and mm-hmm. notion. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Join us. Let's get a call in here. Let's see who have Rudy in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, welcome, Rudy.
Okay. Quick question. Love the work that you guys did back in when we were in the neighborhood, that type of thing. But around 67, 68, 69, there was a group called the October 10, the October 11. They were definitely against drugs. In fact, what they did, from what I can understand, was if they found somebody doing the wrong thing as far as the neighborhood was concerned, they were kind of sort of taken care of in the right way. Anyway, I wanted to know, were they part of the Black Panther Party, if you can answer that?
Well, you know, many organizations that were inspired by different aspects of what the Black Panther Party was about, and maybe because of the fact of who they were and what they wanted to do, they were inspired to move forward in that tradition of the Black Panther Party in relationship to overcoming and dealing with the obstacles that they were confronted with at that time. So they most certainly may have been inspired by who we were during that period.
Rudy, are you speaking locally here?
Baltimore, yes, especially in East Baltimore.
They were not.
Around the Gay Street area, over there around Washington, around Wolf, you would see the painted signs. This particular corner is protected by the October 10 or the October 11, October 12, something like that.
Yeah, they were not, Rudy. They were not a part of the Panther Party. The Panther Party acted in a number of different ways in Baltimore, but we never had a focused effort like that. And I think I know what you're talking about, but never had a focused effort like that against drug dealers. I think it was a little – actually, I think that the time you're talking about also – really falls into about 1970, not 67. It's about 1971, actually.
Right. I remember that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Rudy, thanks so much for being part of the show. We'll come back to the phones here, 410-319-8888. So I'm curious how you feel about where we are now, where you are now. I mean, here it is. I mean, you were one of the last folks in the Black Panther Party. I mean, you were there till almost the bitter end in 1979
yes.
or so,
mm-hmm.
right? And we'll talk about that in a minute. I'll tell you that, but I didn't know that until actually I was preparing for the show and realized that you had stayed in, you were part of it until that point. But now here it is in the 21st century, and your work is like taking off in a sense, in a very different way. I mean, people are pulling you to Ireland, England, New Zealand, all across America to exhibit your work. I'm curious how you take that and what you think is going on and what's your response to what has happened to you and your work now in these last few years.
Well, it shows the impact of the spirit of the times. But at the same time, it also shows that you have people who are in position in galleries and institutions who are more open-minded and want this to be a part of the conversation and see the relevance of it today. And that's very positive because now I began to have conversations with people who weren't aware, who had limited understanding of what that whole history was about. And that's been a plus in that way. It also has been an opportunity to talk to young people all over the world and who are themselves, some of them artists, creative minds, who spoken words, graphic artists, what have you, who are beginning to want to have into a dialogue in their art form about something relevant to change and dealing with that. So it's been a plus in that way. Yes, of course, I have been invited to many places. I was invited to New Zealand, which I spent 41 days. I was invited there to Elam International School of Fine Arts to do a artist in residency. But once it was found out that I was coming and the Polynesian Panthers were there, and it was found out for certain that I was coming, them along with the Maori, the
indigenous people of New Zealand.
The indigenous people there, yeah, invited. They wanted to share with me the whole country. And so when I first came there, they took me directly to the Marae and gave me the official welcoming in their language, and which happened on many occasions while I was there. And I had a chance to go to many galleries and do presentations. There was a at Gus Fisher Gallery, an exhibit that was there of the work that from that period. I went to many culture centers, art institutions, both North and South Island, for 41 days. There was so much response and demand that they had to they couldn't fulfill everything. Yeah, so it was that. And the Polynesian Panthers, which were a chapter of the Black Panther Party, and that came a chapter in 1971.
In
New Zealand.
In New Zealand.
Yes, yes. We couldn't come out and go there, and they couldn't come here. So we used to communicate through people who would come back and forth from time to time. And there are articles in the early editions of the paper showing that link between them and us. Also in Australia, there was the Australian Panthers, which were originally put together by the Polynesian Panthers who went to Australia during that period. You had the London Panthers who were there, who were inspired. And these are organizations and groups that were inspired but had their own cultural identity, you see, during that period. Yeah.
Because, I mean, that happened here in America, too, with groups like the Young Patriots in Chicago.
Yes.
Who were very much like Appalachian Panthers.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
That's existed
right.
There as
yes.
well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. When I saw the Polynesian Panthers on your website, I was like,
oh, yeah, and they just recently finished their documentary on the history. When I went there and did these retrospective presentations, it inspired them to move forward. And so they're completing their documentary, which will be shown on Maori TV there come September around that time. Then it will be shown nationally, internationally. And by the way, my counterpart there, name is Tiki Lou. He's one of the major reggae artists in the Pacific Islands there today. Yeah. Hopefully, if we have some social time set up tomorrow, I'll have my tapes and you can hear his tapes and hear his music play as well.
And speaking of tomorrow, you have a chance to meet Emery Douglas, see his work at the Cork Gallery, 1601 Guilford Avenue, which is Guilford and Federal Streets. The donations to get in and the whatever you do there, the donations end up going to Eddie Conway's Defense Fund, which we'll talk about here as well.
So. I just want to mention one thing. I will be doing a retrospective presentation, PowerPoint presentation, giving the history and discussion behind the artwork itself as well.
So that's something not to be missed. Mm-hmm. Doesn't come through town that often, so you should check that out. Jimmy Douglas is in the studio along with Paul Coates, 410-319-8888. Come back to these calls coming in just a minute at 410-319-8888. When we talk about its relevance to now, and we talked a bit about Eddie Conway, and I want to come back to the cultural issues because I've found the things that you were saying, Emery, about hip-hop in the world today and the relation to your work and to the direct links. I want to come to that. I think that's really an important piece to talk about. But the idea that the money that's being collected here and the other things we'll talk about happening in September with Eddie Conway, who's in prison for allegedly murdering a police officer in 1968 when he was a member of the Black Panther Party.
That would have been 70.
70? I'm sorry. Thanks. Thank you. Mm-hmm. 1970. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm going to go back to what was revealed. We've all talked about this. I want you to kind of talk about it with our listeners. I mean, what the facts have been revealed about the committee hearings, Frank Church's committee hearings, the other committee hearings, the COINTELPAPERS that came out in the early 70s to show what was going on, to literally destroy, shoot, and kill Black Panthers across this country. And what it says about the situation now where so many dozens of men and women are still in prison from that period of time, and Eddie Conway being one of them, one of the main ones. And to talk about what we know about that, I think it's an important thing to kind of put on the table here.
Yeah. I don't know where Emery wants to go with it, and you can certainly lead. Because I was in the Black Panther Party at that time, I actually was a community worker when Eddie was arrested. And I came fully into the Black Panther Party after the arrest of Eddie and the charging of, I think it was almost 21 people here that actually came under charges. So I have some personal knowledge of that period. And so when I think about Frank Church, when I think about the church committee, when I think about all of the information that came out at that period of how engaged the federal government was, how engaged the state government was, how engaged the city government was, how engaged literally every arm of the United States Armed Forces were engaged in not only bringing down the Black Panther Party, but disrupting any type of legitimate effort of the black community to raise itself to a level of being self-dependent and self-sufficient and being able to speak for itself and express its own interests. When I think about that period, I particularly think about Eddie Conway's case. You know, like I know what happened in the church committee and all of that stuff is out there and available. But I don't know that many people really know what what I like to look at as the conspiracy against Eddie Conway was. And when I say the conspiracy against Eddie Conway, here's what I know. I know that in this Baltimore chapter was a chapter that was organized by the National Security Agency, NSA. That's my understanding. Okay, and it's an understanding that's been documented that Warren Hart, the person that organized this chapter, worked as an agent for NSA, and he worked to create a chapter here that would come under the control of the federal government. I know that at one time, there were as many as 6 different agents, not counting Warren Hart, in this chapter. And I know that those agents encouraged and caused other people to participate in the murder of another alleged police informant that was in the chapter. So I know there was a chapter riddled with informants. I also, and this, all of this, we're thankful. We're so thankful for Larry Gibson. And many people know Larry Gibson as a political advisor, as an attorney. But early on, he was a Panther attorney. And he was the one who exposed actually just how infiltrated the Baltimore chapter was from its inception. I know that Eddie Conway early on became aware. I don't think he even knew the level of infiltration, but he did know that some things were up. I do know that Eddie Conway went out to California, the Central Committee, to carry this out to California and point this out to people that the chapter was infiltrated. And I do know that after that time that Eddie Conway was fingered. okay, when two police officers were shot here in Baltimore, and I don't know that all of these details that everyone has all the knowledge, I know I'm giving them fast, but he was fingered, and he was isolated. He was actually identified after another Panther had been beaten as one of the Panthers involved in a police killing. Now, here's what I have. The person who – Eddie Conway's in jail now, Mark, we're talking about 40 years later,
right,
for two things. There was a police officer, a Sergeant Nolan, Roger Nolan, who made an identity on Eddie Conway, and this was a three-second identity. This was a three – supposedly he saw him on a darkened street after being shot at for 3 seconds, and he saw this man as Eddie Conway. There was a stack of photos that were used in the identity of Eddie Conway that Officer Nolan was shown. Two different stacks. In each of those stacks, the only photo that was the same was Eddie Conway's photo. This is what I know, okay? Based on him identifying Eddie Conway from what we called a stack deck of cards, Eddie Conway was identified by Roger Nolan. There was, again, on the other hand, one other piece of evidence against Eddie Conway, and it was a jailhouse informant who was put into Eddie's cell, and supposedly Eddie confessed to, and part of his confession was that I had sent him on this mission to kill a kill a cop, and in order for him to become a Panther, that's the only way that he could become a Panther. And the flaw in that, and the state's attorney's office here, Peter Ward and him knew it, the flaw in that was I wasn't even in the Panther Party at that time. So it's no way that I could have done that. But they used this testimony to convict Eddie Conway, these two things. We were able to go back. We weren't able to do anything with the police officer. But years later, we were able to go back and track Charles Reynolds, who was the informant. And we were able to lay out his history up to the point that he had testified in a number of cases and traded off his time as he did in Eddie's case. We were able to find him with a private investigator, but we never could get him to shake his story. And part of the reason was the man didn't want his family to know what he had done. This is why Eddie Conway is in jail. That, if you look at any of the transcripts or what have you, you have a jail informant that said that Eddie Conway confessed to him, which none of us, of course, believe. And then you have the testimony of Officer Nolan based on a stacked deck of photos. All of this, Mark, was a part of the local chapter's confrontation with the Baltimore police. And Eddie Conway, unfortunately, is one of the victims that four decades later still stays in jail. So I'm thankful for Emory. Long story short, thankful for Emory coming to town. I'm thankful that the art that Emory created that carried forward our challenge for this community is still relevant to people. And I'm thankful that we can still use that art to access and tap into support and have a discussion about Eddie Conway.
And on that note, we have to take a very, very brief break and come right back to our conversation.
Thank you.
I'm glad you did that. That's why we just stay quiet and let you do it. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, you can go to www.mecu.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We're here in the studio today with Emory Douglas, who is the former Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party, who has become an internationally renowned artist. And in that period, he was the man whose work became iconic in America for the images he created for that newspaper, and you can see his work, hear him lecture, and learn a great deal more tomorrow night at Cork Gallery, 1601 Guilford Avenue. That's at Guilford and Federal. It starts at 7 o'clock. It goes to 7 to 9 p.m. And there will also be limited edition collectible prints for sale of his work. And you can go onto the SteinerShow.org page now and click on the connection. You can see the work, and it'll pop out at you immediately as soon as you see it. Oh, that is him. Yes, that is him, and that is the work. You can check it out now on our website. Paul Coates joins us in studio, who owns Black Plastic Press and is a man who was one of the leaders of the Black Panther Party here in Baltimore City.
Yeah. And Mark, can I just say what we don't have on there, we're also going to have original copies of the Black Panther Party newspaper available for people that Emory is going to autograph. Okay?
Original copies.
That. Yeah, we're going to have that.
Then there will be also T-shirts, silkscreen T-shirts of image of Eddie will be sold also there tomorrow for
right.
people who want to mm-hmm. for the fundraising.
I have to run down with my copies so you can sign those. Number here is 410-319-8888. Go ahead.
Can I mention, too, that the book is out. It's a book that came out, published by Rizzoli Publishing Company, 2007. I have a compilation of over 225 images of the artwork that I did in the book called The Black Panther, The Revolutionary Art of Emory Douglas. It's been very well received everywhere.
By Durant, right?
Yeah, Sam Durant was the curator and the co-publisher of the book. And there's essays in it by Bobby Seale and others dealing with the history, linking it together with the art with the history during that period. And also it was published in limited edition in Japanese as well.
Mm. Interesting. I know that.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. 410-319-8888. A lot of folks are calling in. Let's get to the phones. And Fran, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Got just some brief questions for you gentlemen today. I was one of those little kids that was limited in their knowledge about the Panther movement. I grew up during that era. So could you tell me, please, if the Black Panthers did accomplish all the goals they were seeking to accomplish? Do they exist today? And if so, what are their goals?
Well, the goals that we did achieve was to what you see today is what you hear talked about is social programs and the need for social programs. Those were the things that were a part of the conversation that we put into the public arena, into the political arena during that particular time. So you have the offshoots of the free breakfast program, the free breakfast program for kids. That's a part of that's been acknowledged. That's what the free lunch program came about in the schools and institutions today. It was because of that. Alternative child care was something that we were very high on, and you see a lot of the those particular child care centers and things today as well. So, and also the alternative schools and things of that nature were also a part of the foundation of what the Black Panther Party was trying to implement during that time as well.
Yeah, and Fran, I probably would take a cut at it a different way than Emory. On the one hand, I look at the things like Emory is dealing with as more of legacy of that comes out of the work of the Black Panther Party. The goals of the Black Panther Party, however, the larger goal of the Black Panther Party was certainly to have a radical revolution in this country, a revolution in which people who were oppressed would ultimately have, and particularly the Black community, would ultimately have a complete control of its own destiny, in which it would make a decision about its destiny. And between that time, there were various programs that the Panther Party established to carry people until revolution. Now, what happens is at different periods in the Panther Party, those goals would change. So I don't know that in looking at it, I would look at it and say that the Panther Party accomplished their goals as such. Rather, I would look at it more along the lines that Emory was describing. I would look at, out of pursuit of those goals, what was the legacy? What was the impact of the Black Panther Party? And I think in looking toward that impact, you can see the manifestations of the attempts toward those goals.
And just before we go to John and Leslie, our next two callers up, and the fourth caller is Leo. Leo, we're leaving you to last. Be very honest, since you've been waiting a long time, since you're on almost every day. I want to make sure that the listeners get on as well. We do want to get to you, but the legacy And what we're dealing with today, I think, is important connections to some important connections to make here. I think that you made there were some interviews I've read that you've given over the last few years, Emory, as I was preparing for you coming to town and thinking about where you are today as opposed to where you were then. And one of the things you talked about, two things I want to ask you both about, which that you should. A was your connection between the cultural kind of warriors of today and the world of hip hop and what Ta-Nehisi, your son, is very much involved with in terms of interpreting that for the world today. Mm-hmm. And the connection between the art and the culture of that moment that your work represented then and the world we're in today with the young artists.
Well, there's a whole other dynamics there. There's a group of youngsters today who are inspired and carry on the message, but then there's a whole other dynamics that existed today that didn't exist then. You know, that from then to now, you know, you have the system has co-opted in many ways the legitimate voice and that was reflective of what inspired by what we had done during that time. So they have turned them into now the ones who are selling the Maseratis and the furs and the bling bling, and not only that, you know, you got, and then you got the youngsters who come out today, came out the womb, learn how to use computers. We didn't have that back then.
Right.
You know, you got youngsters today who growing up looking at BET and MTV and stuff like that. You see, you got 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old multimillionaires. You know what I mean? You didn't have those dynamics back then. So you got a whole nother kind of dynamics going on today, you know, and out of that dynamics is driving this me instead of we kind of mentality.
Paul, we're going to go back to the phone, so you want to add to that at all?
No, I think I would leave it alone. I'd leave Emory had a last word on that one. I pretty much agree with him.
Right. John in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, I appreciate the discussion. You know, what I want to say is, back then, back when I was a college student in that time, and, you know, circa 68, 70, my impression of the Black Panthers were, I'm sure, you know, I mean, what did you expect? Did you think that, you know, J. Edgar Hoover, Ed Al were not going to do their duty and you know, and try to break down an organization like that? I mean, all the organizations, particularly the Black ones at the time, it was, you know, it was Vietnam era. And FBI and all other federal agencies were heavily involved, as you pointed out. And so, you know, things were looked at back then as threats. I mean, the Angela Davises and you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I would just like to find, I mean, you know, you almost could, it was sort of, I mean, I almost wanted to make the comparison between, you know, the Black Panthers could have been looked at as a, you know, early Black Tea Party, if you will, but there were many good social programs, I understand, that were involved, but the general idea of the Black Panthers, if you move, you know, go 40 years later, is that it was a violent organization, and I wanted you to comment on that. What did you expect?
Well, the Black Panther Party was a reaction to violence. Black Panther Party wasn't a violent organization. Black Panther Party believed in self-defense. That was the foundation of the Black Panther Party. It would defend himself against oppression, but it was not a violent organization, nor was it like the Tea Party. And as you try to describe it, that shows your narrow, limited understanding, a historical understanding of what the Black Panther Party was about. The Black Panther Party, you had a government officials saying that the Black Panther Party was feeding more hungry children than the United States government. That was why we were attacked, because we were beginning to change the ideals of and the belief systems in this country of how what government wasn't doing and should have been doing in the interest of the people in the communities. So the dynamics wasn't because of our being violent, because we were responding to violence. But we were the ones who were brutalized. We were the ones who were terrorized. And you got a former FBI agent named Swearinger, who retired from the FBI, who acknowledges that he was a part of this group within the FBI, and that in order to be a part of it, you had to hate Black people, because it was about discrediting and destroying the Black liberation movement, Black people in Black Panther Party in general, and in particular during that period.
John, I would just ask you to go back and look at your analogy between the Black Panther Party and the Tea Party and try to find examples there where you see the government setting up people, where you see the government infiltrating the Tea Party and sending people to jail, and where you see anyone in the Tea Party that you can even imagine that would be in jail for 40 years. I think your point, though, I think your point is correct on the way you started, and that part of your analogy I agree with. I think that the Panthers did look at themselves in a confrontation with an armed force, an armed worldwide force that had the power to destroy us at any moment. And in spite of that, most Panthers and other organizations that were active, like along with the Black Panther, these were white, black, Chicano, Asian organizations all around the world, looked at what was against them, looked at the oppression that was being inflicted upon people, and chose to stand firm anyway in the face of that oppression. But I would ask you just to go back and look at that analogy and perhaps just take a deeper look at it, okay?
And I think that would be an interesting conversation for us to have in the future, just around that subject in general, as a conversation here on the show, and I look forward to that. A very quick question, Leslie, from Baltimore, and we'll get a very quick answer.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen.
Yeah, we only have a few minutes left, Leslie, so we've got to get to the point, and I'll let them answer right away. I'm sorry.
Now, are you gentlemen familiar with George Jackson?
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely.
Well, can you make any comments and any, you know, statements about who George Jackson was and, you know, the significance, you know, what part he played in the beginning, because he's from the beginning of the Panthers. And I've noticed that oftentimes when they make reference to the Panthers today, man, they just absolutely forget about who George Jackson was and what part.
Well, he plays a rare role, maybe perhaps in the Bay Area. They have Black August, which is about black history and struggles during a lot of them took place in August. But it's always around the legacy of George Jackson. George Jackson was a young brother who went to prison for a petty crime, who became politicized in prison, became highly respected in the prison system. And when Huey Newton was shot and was in prison for the police killing, when he was attacked and the police got killed, George Jackson sent out the word in prison for them to watch out and protect Huey in the prison. And he also, at that time, asked could he become a field marshal, become a member of the Black Panther Party. And he became the field marshal in the prison system. And he was the one who began to organize inside the prisons. He was very highly respected and became a legend throughout the penal system throughout the United States and the world.
I wish we had more time. We don't. There were so many more things I wanted to get into with you, Emily Douglas, but it's a pleasure to have you in Baltimore. Welcome to the city.
Thank you. It's a pleasure
to
be here.
It's good to have you in the studio. Yeah. Paul Coates, always great to have you here.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for being here, Mark. Thank you. Thank you.
And tomorrow night, Emory Douglas at the Cork Gallery, 1601 Guilford Avenue. So it's at 7 p.m., Guilford and Federal Street. You should be there. It'll be an incredible show. His artwork, books for sale, a really lecture, an interesting PowerPoint presentation on history and his artwork and more, and a good group of people there to be with. And then we'll talk more about this next month, September 23rd. I will be at the Creative Alliance along with many other people for Eddie Conway's memoir and book release. We're reading from his book. It's called Of Riots and Resistance, and we'll tell you more about that as time goes on over the next month. You can join us there for that. And folks, stay with us. We're going to take a very brief break. Come back over the top of the hour and join some folks who just came back from the White House to find out what's going on with gay and lesbian rights in the White House. Stay with us. We'll be right back.